For argument is Tories versus Old Town Bus Service. Mr. Morrison.
Good morning. I'm Douglas Morrison for Noel Torres, the petitioner. Thinking about this oral argument, when you present a case in which the case law seems so directly against your position, you think where do you go? And again, in this case, the issue is, was there an abuse of discretion by the trial court when the trial court rejected the factual statements made by the petitioner or by the plaintiff in opposition to the motion for summary judgment? And you think about discretion, and that's kind of where I came down in thinking about how to handle this issue. There's no showing that the trial court exercised any discretion here. Apparently, discretion seems to imply some sort of measured reasoning, some sort of balancing, some sort of looking at options with respect to making a decision which has a drastic impact, in fact, here a draconian impact, on the case presented by the plaintiff. Here, the trial court, in footnote 1 and in its page 1 to its summary judgment opinion, said very simply, if the package isn't right, if it wasn't presented, if the facts presented by the plaintiff weren't presented in the precise format that I'm looking for, the precise format that the rule seems, without saying so, seems to have imply, and what this court and the court below have often said, you need a separate statement. If we don't have a separate statement, I'm just going to ignore it, regardless of the impact, regardless of the fact that these statements that were rejected really did directly respond to the statements made by the defendant in its statement of uncontested facts. When you have a situation in which a case is going to rise or fall merely on the packaging.
What is the critical fact that you would have liked the judge to consider?
I think that the critical fact comes down to mainly, it's in response to the defendant's statement of undisputed facts number 17, in which, and I don't have the record number, I think it's 95 or 96 in the record, in which Mr. Torres listed the various direct discriminatory statements made by his direct supervisor, Ms. Hogate, which was another fact that was ignored by the trial court, who is the direct supervisor of this individual. When Ms. Hogate was statement saying, you're too old, we're going to replace you with younger drivers, you're a Mexican without a green card, we can get rid of you at any time, which in fact turned out that it was false, but nevertheless.
She wasn't his supervisor.
She was his supervisor.
According to the defendant, she wasn't responsible for his being fired.
Well, she didn't. We're not saying that she had the authority to hire or fire, but when the one person with the ear of the person who has the decision to hire or fire, no one is saying that Ms. Ivory, who was the person who actually did the firing, had no knowledge of it.
Evidence that Ivory relied on Hogate?
There was no one else she could rely on, according to...
What did you show? What fact is even in his statements that she did rely on Hogate?
I believe in Mr. And again, I don't have it right in front of me.
You're suspect she did, but does he have a fact?
The fact is that Ms. Ivory had nothing to do with Mr. Torres.
What's critical is what Hogate told her. What if Hogate told her this is a bad driver, dangerous, and so on, didn't make any discriminatory statement, and Ivory says, okay, you know, so I'm firing him. Then there's no responsibility on the part of the company.
Well, I think there is. I think if Ms. Hogate has...
No.
If Ms. Hogate
no,
is...
No, no. We have a zillion cases dealing with that. If the subordinate employee, suppose the subordinate employee tells the superior employee who has the firing discretion. Something that's true, and that is a legitimate ground for discharge, and doesn't say anything about the discriminatory motivation that may actually be operating on her. And so the top supervisor relies on the valid ground that's been communicated, and that's the basis on which she makes the decision. Then there's no liability.
But that's not the facts here. The facts here is that there was no valid ground.
But what are the facts that... Do you have evidence as to what Hogate said to Ivory?
Whether Hogate's... We have evidence that Hogate... No, directly what Ms. Hogate specifically said to Ms. Ivory? Of course not. That would have been done in private. But we do have evidence...
I mean, you can depose these people, right?
But we do have, I suppose, but again, at this stage...
You could have deposed Hogate and asked her what she said to Ivory, right?
I believe there was an attempt to do that, and the effort by the trial lawyer at that time was rejected because it was untimely.
Well,
but again, I'm saying, yeah, I obviously it could have happened, but what we have here is we have a series of discriminatory comments made by Ms. Hogate.
I think you can't rest there if she doesn't have the firing responsibility. You have to know what Hogate told Ivory.
Well, I think that we can presume what Hogate told Ivory. I believe we have evidence that Mr. Torres complained about Hogate's statements regarding his age, regarding his ethnicity, regarding his race, which turned out not to be appropriately not approved by the court. But we have statements that Mr. Torres complained to the owner of the company about Ms. Hogate's statements. And then when Ms. Hogate becomes the sole ears of the company, the sole person to make recommendations regarding this hiring and firing, and we have evidence of that. We have evidence that Ms. Hogate knew in advance of this supposed, she made up her mind when he refused to sign, when Hogate said, you're gone, before he ever saw Ms. Ivory that morning. It appears that Ms. Hogate had more than just a casual relationship to this decision to hire and fire. And I see that I have a very short amount of time, and I see that it has been exhausted, and I thank you, and we...
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Mr. Blonder?
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue, as counsel put it, is correct. Did the district court abuse its discretion in its interpretation of Local Rule 56.1 in addressing the response to the motion for summary judgment? But I would like to start with the second point, which is what counsel was just arguing with respect to what's the evidence in the record. The undisputed evidence in the record was that Joanne Ivory was the sole decision maker with respect to the plaintiff. So in response to the court's questions about what did Ms. Hogate say to Ms. Ivory, the record is devoid of any communication between Ms. Hogate and Ms. Ivory with respect to the decision. Judge Maravich, in going through the facts, even those facts he said which he doesn't have to consider, he still says even if you do look at them, it still does not create a disputed issue of fact with respect to the termination. The comments to which counsel makes reference from Ms. Hogate were not temporally linked with the decision to terminate the employee. So even if we want to jump the first hurdle and say Judge Maravich abused his discretion, meaning no reasonable person could disagree with the way Judge Maravich interpreted Local Rule 56.1, they still don't get to the second point of it was a loser of position anyways. First point, though, is dispositive. Judge Maravich interpreted Local Rule 56.1 in accord with this court's previous opinions in Sishon and Midwest and other opinions which say the court can require strict compliance with Rule 56.1. Judge Maravich had that posted on his website in a standing order. Everyone was on notice as to how Judge Maravich understood and interpreted Local Rule 56.1. There's no suggestion, there's no evidence of any court interpreting it differently. It's not that they come to this court and say, well, there's a difference of opinion as to how Local Rule 56.1 should be interpreted. There's not. It's a set issue. Judge Maravich took his interpretation of the rule, applied it to the facts, and said, there's nothing here to get past summary judgment. And the other point, and counsel made reference to it, there was counsel, not Mr. Morrison, but there was counsel admitted to the bar of the Northern District of Illinois representing Mr. Torres in the Northern District. If there's any issue here, it may be that Mr. Torres has a beef with the quality of the representation he received.
And wasn't that lawyer suspended during the pendency of this case?
The lawyer was suspended during the pendency after the summary judgment was filed. After the summary judgment motion was filed, after the response was filed. Pending the ruling, that lawyer was temporarily suspended. That's correct. For reasons having nothing to do with the case. Again, we want to talk about discretion. There's nothing suggesting that Judge Maravich did anything improper in addressing the facts in front of him, the materials in front of him, and there's no evidence that his ruling is incorrect. For these reasons, we suggest that this court affirm Judge Maravich's opinion granting summary judgment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blonder, and thank you to Mr. Morrison. We'll move on to our next case, which is...